Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today on the program, we have two stories related to football, the sport known as soccer in the United States. Russia and Qatar are busy preparing for the next two FIFA World Cups. Activists say the two countries have human rights issues they need to correct. They give examples of employers abusing work crews at World Cup sites. Some of the workers are reported to be setting up buildings or other structures for the games. The activists also note a lack of labor protections in both Russia and Qatar. In some cases, they say, the lack of protections has led to death. In May, the British Broadcasting Corporation documented the jailing of its crew in Qatar. The crew members were arrested after they attempted to film the living conditions of poor migrant workers in Doha, the capital. The workers were helping to prepare the city for the 2022 FIFA World Cup. The crew's cameras were taken and never returned. The Guardian newspaper reported on Nepalese migrants who worked on a project tied to the World Cup stadium. It said that the migrants died at a rate of every 2 days in 2014. Qatar's Labor Ministry disputes the report. The group Human Rights Watch says many employers try to threaten or frighten migrant workers. It says some businesses take the workers' passports so they cannot leave the country. Jane Buchanan works for Human Rights Watch.
They're extremely vulnerable, you know, both because of the government's disregard for basic labor protections and, you know, the conduct of employers who act with impunity in that kind of environment.
Jeff Tinneys is a specialist on business ethics. He says many of the migrant workers are from Nepal, Bangladesh, India, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka. He says they often are treated as slave laborers. He believes young people around the world will one day protest the workers' treatment and pressure companies to force Russia and Qatar to make changes.
I think once the millennials get hold of this, once you see more traffic on social media, it's going to force the other stakeholders, including the corporate sponsors who put their names and their reputations into play when they sponsor activities like those managed by FIFA, to ask themselves, is this what we should be doing? Is this the best way for us to invest?
Jane Buchanan says that Qatar and Russia should protect workers. But she says FIFA also has a responsibility to make sure the laborers are not suffering. And she says the organization must also work to keep from repeating earlier mistakes.
What we saw with the Sochi Winter Olympics was rampant exploitation of migrant workers, building the infrastructure and venues, real disregard on the part of the Russian government until really the very last minute to inspect and hold employers accountable for those abuses. And so I think it sent a pretty strong signal that those kinds of practices are basically tolerated.
Russian lawmakers have proposed using prisoners to help develop areas for the 2018 World Cup. Ms. Buchanan says that could place the prisoners at extreme risk of being forced to work as slaves. She says the Russian government has already weakened labor protections for workers at the World Cup site. You are listening to As It Is from VOA, Learning English. In 1971, A table tennis competition led to a meeting between the President of the United States, Richard Nixon, and China's leader, Mao Zedong. Their talks led the two countries to normalize relations. Recently, a group of Chinese and exiled Tibetans played at a women's soccer event in Germany. It was the first recorded meeting between Chinese and Tibetan athletes since the 1959 Lhasa Rebellion against Chinese rule. It was also the first ever trip by a Tibetan women's sports team to another country. Jim Tedder has more.
Players from Shanghai Sports University and the Tibet Women's Soccer Program met last Sunday near part of the former Berlin Wall. The Tibet Women's Soccer Program is based in Dehradun, India. Cassie Childers is the team's manager.
It was a really amazing moment, and our Tibetan girls just ran to meet them and started hugging them and greeting them. And the Chinese players were a little, they had this look of shock on their faces. I think they didn't know that there was going to be a team from Tibet here. They don't know anything about what's going on inside Tibet. They didn't understand why our girls were living as refugees in India. And the really amazing thing is they were open to listening to the stories, and now they know.
Monday marked the 80th birthday of the Dalai Lama. He has repeatedly called on China to permit greater self-rule in Tibet. There has been no official contact between the Chinese government and Tibet's exiled administration for 5 years. In Berlin, Tibetan and Chinese athletes played side by side. There were 3 Tibetans and 4 Chinese on the team Sunday night. They won 3-1 in the finals. The German Foreign Ministry and Discover Football jointly organized the competition. Leah Golnitz is with Discover Football. She says it would have been very different to set up an event with a Chinese national team and a men's team from Tibet. She says this shows that in women's football, there is more space to work around big political issues. The competition took place at the same time as a women's football conference called Beyond Borders. Players from 27 countries, including Afghanistan and Uganda, attended the conference. Discussions and training were held throughout the event. The conference included a meeting with German Prime Minister Angela Merkel. For the delegate from Afghanistan, Beyond Borders provided her first chance to play football under open skies and in front of men and women. In many parts of the world, there are still restrictions on women playing in sport. Yangdan Lamo is a Tibetan player. She says her team took a Tibetan flag with them for a photograph at the German Parliament building. She says they wanted to show that Tibet is still a global issue. VOA first reported on Tibetan women's soccer 2 years ago. The discrimination against women still exists among sports administrators in the exile community. Not long ago, Cassie Childers cut her ties to the Tibetan National Sports Association. She acted after the group's executive chairman raised questions about the need for a women's soccer team touring other countries.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
from VOA Learning English. This is In the News. World powers have been working for years to limit Iran's nuclear activities. But news reports often fail to provide details of the nuclear negotiations. Today, we explore some of the issues that the negotiators have been discussing. Western countries have targeted the equipment that Iran needs to produce plutonium and enriched uranium. Both materials are needed to make a nuclear weapon. Not just any uranium can be used. The metal must be purified or enriched. It is first changed into a gas. Workers then place the gas into a machine called a centrifuge. The centrifuge makes the gas spin at very high speeds. The spinning creates the enriched uranium required at nuclear power centers. But if the gas is put in centrifuges for long periods, it becomes enriched at a much higher level. This highly enriched uranium can be used in nuclear weapons. Under the agreement, Iran will still have the ability to make fuel for its nuclear reactors, but it will not be permitted to enrich uranium for use in nuclear weapons. In April, Iran agreed to a limit of about 6,000 centrifuges. Iran also said it would only enrich uranium at very low levels, under 5%. The country promised to store no more than 300 kilograms of this low-enriched uranium. The April agreement limited research on ways to improve centrifuge designs. It also covered Iran's ability to produce plutonium, the other bomb-making material. It required the redesign of a nuclear reactor so that it can use natural uranium instead of the enriched kind. Natural uranium is nearly all U-238, the heavier form of the element. When a neutron strikes this form of uranium, the atom will change into plutonium. This heavy water reactor can produce radioactive chemicals used to treat cancer. When the redesign is completed, it will still make those chemicals, but produce much less plutonium. Under the New Deal, Iran has agreed to increased international inspections of its nuclear activities. The country is also required to provide detailed information on all its nuclear activities within 3 months. Western powers have agreed to lift trade restrictions on Iran. They will also return control of billions of dollars to Iran as soon as it meets the requirements of the agreement. In Washington, President Barack Obama said on Wednesday that the agreement stops Iran from building a nuclear weapon. He said it will make the United States, its allies, and the world safer and more secure. Some members of Mr. Obama's party do not support the agreement, and most of his political opponents strongly oppose it. When members of Congress are given the agreement, they will have 60 days to decide whether to reject it. The president has said if they do, he will veto the rejection. The votes of at least 2/3 of lawmakers are needed to cancel his veto. And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Now, the special English program, American Stories. Our story is called The Diamond Lens. It was written by FitzJames O'Brien. Today we will hear the second and final part of the story. Here is Morris Joyce with part two of The Diamond Lens.
When I was a child, someone gave me a microscope. I spent hours looking through that microscope, exploring nature's tiny secrets. As I grew up, I became more interested in my microscope than in people. When I was 20 years old, my parents sent me to New York City to study medicine. I never went to any of my classes. Instead, I spent all my time and a lot of my money trying to build the perfect microscope. I wanted to make a powerful lens that would let me see even the smallest parts of life. But all my experiments failed. Then, one day, I met a young man who lived in the apartment above mine. Jules Simon told me about a woman who could speak to the dead. When I visited Madame Volpe's, she let me speak to the spirit of the man who invented the microscope. The spirit of Anton Leeuwenhoek told me how to make a perfect lens from a diamond of 140 carats. But where could I find a diamond that big? When I returned home, I went to Simon's apartment. He was surprised to see me and tried to hide a small object in his pocket. I wanted to discover what it was, so I brought two bottles of wine to his apartment. We began to drink. By the time we had finished the first bottle, Simon was very drunk. "Simon, I know you have a secret. Why don't you tell me about it?" Something in my voice must have made him feel safe. He made me promise to keep his secret. Then he took a small box from his pocket. When he opened it, I saw a large diamond shaped like a rose. A pure white light seemed to come from deep inside the diamond. Simon told me he had stolen the diamond from a man in South America. He said it weighed exactly 140 carats. Excitement shook my body. I could not believe my luck. On the same evening that the spirit of Leeuwenhoek tells me the secret of the perfect lens, I find the diamond I need to create it. I decided to steal Simon's treasure. I sat across the table from him as he drank another glass of wine. I knew I could not simply steal the diamond. Simon would call the police. There was only one way to get the diamond. I had to kill Simon. Everything I needed to murder Simon was right there in his apartment. A bottle full of sleeping powder was on a table near his bed. A long, thin knife lay on the table. Simon was so busy looking at his diamond that I was able to put the drug in his glass quite easily. He fell asleep in 15 minutes. I put his diamond in my pocket and carried Simon to the bed. I wanted to make the police think Simon had killed himself. I picked up Simon's long, thin knife and stared down at him. I tried to imagine exactly how the knife would enter Simon's heart if he were holding the knife himself. I pushed the knife deep into his heart. I heard a sound come from his throat, like the bursting of a large bubble. His body moved, and his right hand grabbed the handle of the knife. He must have died immediately. I washed our glasses and took the two wine bottles away with me. I left the lights on, closed the door, and went back to my apartment. Simon's death was not discovered until 3 o'clock the next day. One of the neighbors knocked at his door, and when there was no answer, she called the police. They discovered Simon's body on the bed. The police questioned everyone, but they did not learn the truth. The police finally decided Jules Simon had killed himself. And soon, everyone forgot about him. I had committed the perfect crime. For 3 months after Simon's death, I worked day and night on my diamond lens. At last, the lens was done. My hands shook as I put a drop of water on a piece of glass. Carefully, I added some oil to the water to prevent it from drying. I turned on a strong light under the glass and looked through the diamond lens. For a moment, I saw nothing in that drop of water, and then I saw a pure white light. Carefully, I moved the lens of my microscope closer to the drop of water. Slowly, the white light began to change. It began to form shapes. I could see clouds and wonderful trees and flowers. These plants were the most unusual colors, bright reds, greens, purples, as well as silver and gold. The branches of these trees moved slowly in a soft wind. Everywhere I looked, I could see fruits and flowers of 1,000 different colors. How strange, I thought, that this beautiful place has no animal life in it. Then I saw something moving slowly among the brightly colored trees and bushes. The branches of a purple and silver bush were gently pushed aside, and there, before my eye, stood the most beautiful woman I had ever seen. She was perfect. Pink skin, large blue eyes, and long golden hair that fell over her shoulders to her knees. She stepped away from the rainbow-colored trees like a flower. Floating on water, she drifted through the air. Watching her move was like listening to the sound of tiny bells ringing in the wind. She went to the rainbow-colored trees and looked up at one of them. The tree moved one of its branches that was full of fruit. It lowered the branch to her, and she took one of the fruits. She turned it in her tiny hands and began to eat. How I wished I had the power to enter that bright light and float with her through those beautiful forests. Suddenly, I realized I had fallen in love with this tiny creature. I loved someone who would never love me back, someone who was a prisoner in a drop of water. I ran out of the room, threw myself on my bed, and cried till I fell asleep. Day after day, I returned to my microscope to watch her. I never left my apartment. I rarely even ate or slept. One day, as usual, I went to my microscope, ready to watch my love. She was there, but a terrible change had taken place. Her face had become thin, and she could hardly walk. The wonderful light in her golden hair and blue eyes was gone. At that moment, I would have given my soul to become as small as she and enter her world to help her. What was causing her to be so sick? She seemed in great pain. I watched her for hours, helpless and alone with my breaking heart. She grew weaker and weaker. The forest also was changing. The trees were losing their wonderful colors. Suddenly, I realized I had not looked at the drop of water for several days. I had looked into it with the microscope, but not at it. As soon as I looked at the glass under the microscope, I understood the horrible truth. I had forgotten to add more oil to the drop of water to stop it from drying. The drop of water had disappeared. I rushed again to look through the lens. The rainbow forests were all gone. My love lay in a spot of weak light. Her pink body was dried and wrinkled. Her eyes were black as dust. Slowly, she disappeared forever. I fainted and woke many hours later on pieces of my microscope. I had fallen on it when I fainted. My mind was as broken as the diamond lens. I crawled to my bed and withdrew from the world. When I finally got better, months later, all my money was gone. People now say I am crazy. They call me Linley, the mad scientist. No one believes I spoke to the spirit of Leeuwenhoek. They laugh when I tell them how I killed Jules Simon and stole his diamond to make the perfect lens. They think I never saw that beautiful world in a drop of water. But I know the truth of the diamond lens, and now so do you.
You have just heard The Diamond Lens by Fitzjames O'Brien. It was adapted for Special English by Donna DeSanctis. Your storyteller was Morris Joyce. Listen again next week for another American story told in Special English on The Voice of America. This is Shirley Griffith.